Covering the Western Hockey League from south of the border, this is the U.S. Division Podcast. Welcome to episode 9 of the U.S. Division Podcast. My name is Scott Sepich, and it is playoff time here in the Western Hockey League. It has really gone by fast this season. Seems like just a couple of weeks ago, I was out in Saskatoon at the Memorial Cup, and here we are with another playoff season about ready to get underway. I'm going to be doing a series of podcasts here with bloggers who cover U.S. Division teams, and tonight going to start with Tyler Hunnix, who covers the Seattle Thunderbirds for his site, which is called letsgobirds.com. So looking forward to getting his perspective on things as a fan, which is kind of a cool, different perspective than when I might talk to other writers who have to be a little bit more diplomatic. Somebody like Tyler and a couple of the other folks I'm going to talk to soon can wear their emotions on their sleeves a little bit more, so I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully soon going to be talking to bloggers both with Spokane and Portland, so going to be some interesting stuff as we head into the playoffs, and then hopefully as the playoffs continue, check in with some other folks that I've talked to in the past and give some hopefully some decent coverage here to the U.S. teams in the playoffs. But for now, we're going to get right to it with Tyler. All right, now we're going to be joined by the, I guess I'll say the proprietor of letsgobirds.com, a Seattle Thunderbirds blog, Tyler Hunnix. Thanks for joining me, Tyler.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
Can't believe the playoffs are already upon us. It seems like it's gone by very fast. But Thunderbirds, Silver Tips, I imagine that this is a series that you guys have wanted to happen for a long time, and now it's here.
Yeah, it seems like every year, you know, fans have sort of looked at the standings, and it seemed like every January or February, things would kind of get closer towards the end of the season. And, you know, it wasn't something that we were super focused on as fans, but you'd kind of look at the standings and you'd say, yeah, they're definitely not going to meet in the first round, and doesn't look like they probably will meet in the second or third round. And that seems, you know, possible, but unlikely, and another year would go by and you wouldn't get the Seattle Everett matchup. And so, yeah, definitely. I mean, this seems insane that it can go 11 years in the same conference and not face each other.
Yeah, not only are you getting it now, but it's not like it's some sort of wild mismatch. I mean, these are two teams that had the exact same number of points in the regular season, right?
Yeah, and kind of an interesting – we're at interesting confluence points, I guess, is what I would say, because certainly there have been reports of, you know, the players, the Seattle players, being quite excited in the locker room on Sunday after Everett had lost in the shootout to Portland, earning that fourth spot, because they had come into the season with the fourth seed being one of their goals. But certainly odd circumstances a little bit, I would say, coming into it, where it looked like, even as little as a couple of weeks ago, that fourth was inevitable and they'd have to hold off Spokane for fourth. And then suddenly, you know, Everett's now hasn't lost in regulation in 13 games, and the Thunderbirds went from playing really well at the tail end of January and then kind of went into a little bit of a tailspin and hadn't played very well recently, and more or less stumbled into the fourth seed over the weekend after getting, you know, pretty well dominated by Portland on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, it seemed like the highlight for the last maybe 2-3 weeks for the Thunderbirds was the one time they beat Portland up there. It seemed like it all came together for one game, and then they just sort of fell off the cliff a little bit again after that.
Yeah, and that's sort of been the MO for the team, you know, actually for a lot of the season. It's, you know, they got off to a decent start and then went on the first half of the Eastern swing, or, you know, the road trip, and stumbled, and then came back and lost a really ugly one on New Year's Eve. It was the first time, you know, as you probably know, first time in a while, in a long time. I can't even remember how many years it's been that the Thunderbirds didn't play in Portland on New Year's Eve and hosted Kamloops, a team that didn't even come close to making the playoffs. And I think I'd have to look at it again, but I think off the top of my head, Kamloops only won, like, I think 13 or 14 games in regulation all year, and were just spanked at home 7-1 to the Blazers on New Year's Eve. And it sort of looked like, oh, geez, like, here we go again, which is an all too familiar feeling for Thunderbird fans. And then January came around, and everybody sort of had that feeling that you know, here we go again feeling, because the T-Birds have really slumped in January in the past, you know, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 seasons even going back. And magically in the second half of January, I think they reeled off about 9 consecutive wins, and things seemed to be looking up. And then they had a couple of stumbles again, and they've sort of gotten cold here at the end of the season. Now, I think they would probably tell you that injuries are a big part of that, and certainly – they got Scott Enzer back, I think it was the week before last, from injury, and he's kind of an underrated aspect of the team. And I think that right now, outside of Connor Honey, they're about as healthy as they've been in a while. So,
I was going to say about Enzer, I remember thinking the last time that Seattle was here at Portland playing that Enzer was probably the one player in the league with only 5 goals who impressed me the most.
He's really an underrated player, and he's got a lot more. He doesn't get a lot of press, and I think that'll change over time. But he's got more talent than I think people realize, and he's also one of those guys. You know, he came from Colorado from last year. He signed with the Thunderbirds in the offseason, and it took him a while to kind of get, you know, the WHL speed going. And I think that happens to a lot of kids. I mean, that even happened to Ryan Gropp to a certain extent, who came in, of course, with a lot of fanfare being a first-round pick. And he struggled quite a bit the first, you know, I'd say 5, 6, 7 games, you know, getting up to the speed of this league. And so initially he struggled, and there wasn't a whole lot of success. But he's really come on. And I would say around the November, December point, Enzer had really solidified himself. He found a couple of line mates in Jamin Jakubowski and Sam McKechnie, and they've sort of become that shutdown line. But I think he's probably got more skill than that as well. I think, you know, next couple of years we'll see some offense out of him as well.
Yeah, his penalty killing has really impressed me all year.
Yeah, excellent. It seems like, I mean, the one good thing it seems like Seattle has had the last couple of years is good penalty killers. McKechnie's a good penalty killer as well, and Inzer's a good penalty killer. But for sure, yeah, he's been excellent on the power, on the penalty kill when he's been healthy.
You talk about a good stretch that the team had in January. A lot of that coincided with Taron Cozen arriving and him putting up some fairly ridiculous numbers for a stretch of time there. How much of that success maybe in that era was that? Was the team really that much better at that point, or was Cozen just playing so out of his mind that the team was winning games, or was there something going on just overall with the team?
You know, probably like a lot of things, it was a combination. I don't think it was one thing in particular. You know, I don't think necessarily that. I think the goaltending, put it this way, I think the goaltending probably got a little bit of a bad rap before Cozen came here. Justin Miles and Danny Mumma combined, you know, there were games where, sure, there was a goal here and there that they would have wanted to come, you know, to have back. But I think there were also a lot of games where you could be pretty honest with yourself and sit there and say, you know, this is really not a goaltender problem that we're having tonight. I mean, this is, you know, three power play goals. This is, you know, 2 or 3 backdoor goals. This is tap ins. These are goals that are not really goaltender problems. And so I don't know that it was really fair to have blamed the goaltenders before that. But certainly when Cozen came in, he just really kind of settled things down. I think that was the biggest factor. Is he came in, everybody knew, okay, this is a guy who's been around. He was hungry to get his own, to really get his shot. coming over from Kamloops, and he really kind of settled things down, because it seemed like that not only did he play very well, but the defense played really well in front of him as well. They limited the really high quality opportunities, and Cozen kind of took care of the rest. And yeah, for a while there, I mean, you know, he shut out Spokane, I believe, two or three games in a row, and really had dominated them for a stretch, and things kind of came together.
Were you surprised that they did not fill all of the 20-year-old slots at the deadline, or did that concern you really?
You know, personally, it did, and it does surprise me, because I just think in general that a team, you know, I guess what I would say is that if you have the opportunity to fill three spots, you might as well fill them. You know, it's sort of like if you're allowed 320s and you're allowed two imports, you probably should fill those spots unless you're compelled not to. I can understand the argument of where they came from. I think their stance is that they had a lot of 19-year-olds. You know, there's 10 19-year-olds on the team now. 19's not a whole lot different than 20. And if you can't find 20-year-olds that are, you know, demonstratively better than your 19-year-olds, then why go out and overpay for it? I tend to think that maybe there were opportunities out there to get those, but then again, you know, that's sort of armchair quarterbacking. I mean, I'm not on the phones every day, you know, trying to find out what the prices were on some of the 20-year-olds early in the season, but it certainly seemed like they could have filled those 20-year-old spots. That's probably what my preference would be, but I think probably a bigger question mark for me was the fact that the one 20-year-old they kept as a guy in Mitch Elliott, who certainly is a wonderful kid, seems like a great young man, very intelligent, and he's certainly tough as nails, and he's drawn some attention from some NHL clubs. I know he got invited to the Washington Capitals camp, but as far as production, you know, on the ice and actually providing you with, you know, say points and things that will actually show up in the score sheet, that he has not, you know, fulfilled that too much outside of the occasional fight here and there. Although he has a hard time finding a fight because he's generally such a good fighter and so tough, he has a little bit of a hard time finding dance partners these days.
Yeah. You shipped Seth Swenson out and basically got Maxwell was part of that trade, right?
Correct, yeah.
And Maxwell's not coming back next year, no matter what, from what
he's
I understand.
He's not, no.
What did you think of that deal? Was there a big difference there between those two guys? I kind of feel bad for Swenson, because he's... All of a sudden, the team's performing well, and he gets shipped off to Lethbridge for the
end of
his career.
Feel a little bit bad for Swenson. I think it had become apparent with Swenson that there were, you know, and I hate to borrow exact phraseology from Russ Farwell, but I believe the quote was that, you know, the younger players, look at that, I almost said our, their younger players had begun to push, you know, players like Swenson for playing time. And certainly, you know, if you're going to carry a 20-year-old, and they're doing it basically right now in Mitch Elliott, but it seemed odd to carry 20-year-olds that, you know, weren't going to play on your power play much, weren't going to play on your penalty kill much, and weren't going to get a ton of ice time. And if you had younger players that you felt like you needed to get on the ice, you know, I think around the same time, Calvin Spencer had come in from Minnesota. Some other kids had, you know, Brian Gropp had obviously reported earlier in the season there had been kind of some dwindling opportunities for ice time. Coupled with that, I was also kind of equally surprised at the shipping out of Eric Benoit. I mean, that was kind of an odd deal. You know, that certainly seemed like a guy who was, you know, could do a few things. I thought he was a good passer. I thought he had pretty good vision, could play on the penalty kill a little bit, although, as we discussed, it's not like Seattle was necessarily short on penalty killers. But that was a guy I was kind of surprised that got sent out under what seemed like the cover of darkness. So there have certainly been some decisions made with the 20-year-olds that I'd have to say that I didn't fully understand. That might be stating it somewhat mildly.
Down here in Portland, you know, the Winterhawks traded for Corbin Boze at the deadline and paid a pretty high price. It was a second rounder and a roster player, Stephen Aldridge, plus Shane McColgan, who was never going to play in Lethbridge, but I kind of theorized that maybe Seattle drove the price of that up a little bit and then sort of settled for Cozen as a 19-year-old, and they've ended up, you could argue, they're better off with Cozen anyway, but it just seemed kind of easy to me that you would have filled in a 20-year-old spot with a goalie there, and then when all this kind of shook out, you ended up getting Kozin for less of a price than Portland paid for Bowes.
Yeah, and I don't know that's necessarily true. I don't have any inside knowledge to that extent, but that certainly wouldn't surprise me. And I had heard, I guess I would say this, I had heard rumblings that possibly Seattle was in on Bowes as well. So that wouldn't surprise me, and that certainly seems logical. I mean, you've got two division rivals essentially both seemingly in a position to get a veteran goaltender, although I think you could maybe make an argument that at the deadline there, Seattle probably needed one more so than Portland did. Not that was a bad move on Portland's part to get a veteran goaltender down the stretch, but that wouldn't surprise me. And as you said, Kozin has worked out so well that it seems like that has worked out well, for them to not end up with Bowes and maybe not pay the price that Portland did.
Yeah, and Bowes has been really good here too. So it's I don't know if there's necessarily a huge difference, but
yeah.
And I had heard back in November even that Portland was interested in Bowes.
Yeah.
But also had been told towards the deadline that there was another team actively pursuing him, and the only one that made sense to me was Seattle. So
yeah,
absolutely. I never got that confirmed, but it, to me that was the only one that seemed to really make sense.
Yeah, absolutely, and that seems to make sense to me. I wouldn't have been surprised by that at all.
I read your post today, letsgobirds.com, kind of review going over the playoff series with Everett. I know you actually have chosen Everett in six games.
Yeah, I don't think I'm a very popular figure around the front office in the locker room these days. I spent 2 days basically telling everybody how unhappy I was. So I don't know that I better be careful showing my face around there this weekend.
Do you media stuff there at the games, or do you just go as a fan?
I do not. I go as a fan, and in fact, I've wrestled with the website a little bit over the years because, I started it about 6 years ago now. And it became, as you can probably imagine, it's become sort of a labor of love. And now that I've got, two little additions to the family, time has become a little bit more difficult. But even before that, I guess in some ways I kind of miss going to the games and just being a fan. And that kind of started a little bit last season. It became a little bit more stressful to worry about what I was going to write about and coming up with coherent thoughts and coherent opinions and not being able to just go to the game and have a few adult beverages and have a nice time. But yeah, I started the blog website about 6 or 7 years ago, and it started from the genesis of it was that I just couldn't believe that Seattle, didn't get more coverage, and it was frustrating as a fan who I grew up, when I was a little kid, I grew up being a big fan and going to games in Mercer Arena and the old Coliseum, and then I had what I actually refer to as the dark years, where I kind of I quit playing hockey when I was 14 and went to high school, and my interests sort of changed a little bit and went to college down in Oregon. I actually went to Willamette University down in Salem.
Oh yeah.
And so I sort of have like a dark, what I call the dark ages of about 7 or 8 years where, guys will tell me about players or ask me like, hey, remember when that happened? They go, no, I don't. I have no idea. There's about 7 or 8 years there. I have no clue. But I came back, and once I'd gotten out of school and started going to games again and really got into it. And it was really frustrating that there just wasn't very much coverage, and it wasn't that the coverage was bad. Jim Riley from the Times, would do an article, I think it was at least every other Friday, maybe it was every Friday on the weekend series, and would profile a player, and he did a nice job, but that just didn't seem like enough when it was you would get one article in the paper every week, and Seattle would do things like, the trades would happen, or players would get sent away, or players would come in, or training camp would happen, and there was no coverage of it. Nobody was talking about it, and there were certainly a demand for it. I mean, when you talk to fans, there's a what I like to call a small group of the hardcore Thunderbird fans that eat, sleep, and breathe Thunderbirds, and they want to talk about it and they want to debate it, and so it seemed like kind of a natural thing. And the thing just sort of grew into a monster. And we've changed over the years. I've obviously brought in another writer this year, my buddy John Whiting, who's one of what I would call the hardcore Thunderbird fans. And John's sort of feeling his way through, learning how to be a better writer. And he's not a whole lot different than what I was. I don't necessarily have a writing background. I don't have any sort of journalistic background. It just sort of started from a passion and tried to improve over time, and John's going through the same thing, and he's done a fantastic job for us. And that's kind of the genesis of it. But it sort of became where I didn't have as much time to write, and things have kind of trailed off, but now we're trying to kind of get to swing back through for the playoffs here and really follow through with this thing to the end of the season.
Yeah, that's cool, because Portland has, in a lot of ways been in the same boat in terms of coverage periodically over the years, certainly since the ownership change down here and the team has gotten better again. I've done a lot of the coverage for the Oregonian over the last 5 years, but different staff writers have been doing coverage there, so they've improved, and I've always, kind of like you, been saddened that the Thunderbirds didn't get as much coverage up there anymore. And I think that how much do you think playing in Kent has sort of pushed them even further off the radar there?
I actually don't think it's changed a whole lot. They were barely on the radar. I noticed some quotes. I was flipping through some old stuff in preparation for the article I wrote about the series. I was flipping through old articles when Bill Ewell had sold the franchise to Russ Farwell and had purchased the rights to the expansion franchise in Everett, and there were several quotes in there from the Seattle ownership group about being the small fish in a major market, and Portland definitely gets some of that, although the difference is with Portland is that in Portland, as the main attraction for many, many years was obviously the Trailblazers, and then more recently the Timbers. But the Winterhawks got at least a fair share of coverage and a fair share of interest. I remember being down there when Winterhawks games and recaps and results would be on the front page of the paper. I can't remember the last time that a Thunderbird picture would have appeared on the front sports page of the Times or anything like that. So I don't know that it's really changed a lot. I will say that I think there's a general notion amongst the fan base that we thought we would catch maybe a little bit more of the regional lightning in the bottle that Everett caught up in Everett when we moved down to Kent. Thought there'd be maybe a little bit more city pride, that there'd be a little bit more some more new fans from Kent that discovered, oh, hey, we've got a team now for our city. And I don't know that there's a lot of that. I think it's growing. But I think it takes time. And my favorite quote to tell people, when fans complain about attendance is that, no matter what, wins drive attendance. And if you win, people will go. And, that's certainly been evident this year as well. Attendance has been up. I think average attendance is up about 300 and some odd people. And I think that's reflective of the fact that the team is better this year. They've been awful, awful bad for three or four seasons now, and you start to win more games and the casual fan shows up and the team actually wins 5-2, or they beat Portland 5-2, and there's a few fights and the game's exciting and they're likely to come back for another game. But in the past several seasons, the casual fans showed up and the team's lost, or in some cases gotten run out of the building, and it's a little bit more difficult to bring your kids back to another game when the game wasn't much fun.
Yeah, in fact, Portland and Seattle are the only two teams in the league this year that had attendance increases.
Yeah, which is pretty remarkable, actually. I'm obviously very biased because one of my very, very good friends is Sean Runnels, who is director of ticket sales here for the Thunderbirds, and so I'm obviously a little bit biased. So I'll throw that out there as a disclaimer. But I think that they've actually done a pretty darn good job of selling tickets, and especially in the scenario, the last several years where the team just has not been very good, and for them to actually have kind of maintained a reasonable fan base, and then seeing this increase this year, I think is actually pretty good. I know there's a faction of fans out there that would like to think and see, you know, a 6,000 seat venue sold out every weekend for every game. But the fact of the matter is that this is not Medicine Hat. I think that that's probably a little bit, just a tad unrealistic until they start putting together some really, really championship worthy seasons. And then you might see something like that.
So speaking of ticket sales, one of the couple of playoff topics I wanted to cover, and this is something that you've had your opinion on that I think you've said is kind of unpopular right now, is about the scheduling of this particular series. It is a usually a playoff series follows the 2-2-1-1-1 format, but the Thunderbirds have decided to give away Game 2 on this weekend in order to have Game 3 at home on a Tuesday, which is a big promotion night up there. And you've been a little bit critical of this, and ultimately, though, I guess, kind of explain your position on what you think about that decision.
Well, I think that, I guess in summary, and then I'll go back and I'll see if I can put together a coherent argument for it. But I think the problem in summary is that at worst, at very worst, or I should say at very best, it means nothing. So I don't think that by foregoing Game 2 at home and moving that to Game 3 specifically to get on a Tuesday night to put on your 2 for Tuesday promotion, which I'll expand on, I don't think that that helps you any. And I think at worst it might hurt you a little bit. Certainly the argument that I outlined was that statistically speaking, over the history of the NHL, teams that gain a 2-0 advantage tend to win their series like 90% of the time, whereas teams that take a 2-1 series lead after having game one at home tend to win the series, I think it was about 86 or 87% of the time. Now, I also sort of pointed out within the post that probability-wise, and I don't want to get too nerded out here for you, but probability-wise, of course, it shouldn't matter, right? I mean, if you play four games at home and you play three games on the road, you could play them all, and you can play them all in a vacuum. It shouldn't matter, but we all know that there's a reason why games are not played on paper, and games are not played based on statistics. They're based on real people and real actions and real emotions. And you know, my concern is that if you drop, say, game one, and you have to go up to Everett, and you drop game two in what'll, you know, most likely be a pretty energetic and charged crowd up there, you've now found yourself in an 0-2 hole. And that 0-2 hole would be an 0-2 hole if you had lost the first two games at home. But at least if you, say, lose one of the games at home out of the first two, you could reasonably look at the situation and say, well, we still salvaged a split if we lost the first one, but then we came back and won the second one. So I think the problem is that you leave yourself susceptible to some momentum swings here, where you could have had the opportunity to maybe seize that momentum. But I know that, you know, and the other part of the argument, the second part of it was, is that it seems pretty clear at this point that the decision was made based on business reasons, and that bothers me a little bit, because I think that ultimately I realize that the team has to make money. You know, the team has to make money, no different than the Portland Winterhawks have to make money, and the Everett Silvertips have to make money, and every team in the league has to make money, and especially some of the teams in the smaller markets have to make money, because you know, it's somewhat difficult in this league to break even in some cases. But I think that ultimately the goal should be, if you're going to have a team, that you're trying to win games. And that, you know, the analogy I used to one of my friends was, the Seattle Seahawks make money hand over fist, but nobody laments the money that they're making, because they clearly put winning first and they've put a quality product out on the field. The Seattle Mariners, on the other hand, make pretty good money as well, but everybody bemoans the fact that they make money and their team has been crappy for years. Right. So it sort of feels like, you know, you're putting the cart before the horse when you're saying, well, we're making this for business decisions, and we don't know for a fact that there's any, you know, competitive advantage gained from it. Now, I know from talking to people that they do think that there's a notion that they believe that pretty reasonably, there'll be a bigger crowd on Tuesday night than there would have been on a Friday night. And I don't dispute that as well. I think the crowd probably will be about, a thousand people bigger than it would have been on Friday night. The problem is that so far this season, the team has performed pretty poorly in front of big crowds. So I'm not really sure what kind of competitive advantage that they're going to gain by putting an extra thousand people in the seats to be a little bit louder. But, I hope I'm wrong. I said that in the post, and I'll say it again here. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that it I hope it doesn't come back to bite them. I hope we win game one. I hope we steal game two up in Everett, and we come back on Tuesday and win a game three at home and take a stranglehold 3-0. But we'll have to wait and see how that works out.
Yeah, I'll have to go back. A couple of years ago, I had written about, this was when Calvin Pickard was still on the team, and how they didn't they chose not to trade him at the deadline in his final season, and that surprised some people. And I went back and looked, because they were still in the hunt for a playoff spot there. I think they were hovering around 9th or so and had a chance to get to 8th. And I had seen that there was some issues financially with the arena in Kent, and that there was something to be gained by just getting to 8th place financially, just to have a couple games. And that maybe that might have motivated, in some way, motivated them not trading Pickard. And I had thought about things like, well, they could do, if they need to make more money, they could do things like charge for parking, because they don't even do that right now. $2, you know?
Yeah, although I do think that, I just to address that specifically, I don't think that they're allowed to charge for parking, to be honest, because I think it's written in the, I think it's part of the city of Kent's bylaws. I don't think you can charge for parking anywhere in Kent.
Oh, in Kent, that's a city
law. Yeah. So I think that is actually, I'll give them a legitimate pass on that one, because I don't think that they can charge for parking. But I tend to agree with you, and it's, you know, it's another one of those situations where you I hear things, and you have to be a little bit careful about what you actually put out there to the public and what's just rumor and what's not. But I think you can pretty reasonably put together a 2-2 argument that there have been very public reports about the arena not making as much money as the city thought. You go back to, at the time, you're absolutely right. The Thunderbirds were fighting for a spot in the playoffs and getting the 8th seed in the playoffs, even if that meant two home playoff games. That certainly is additional revenue that would have been helpful to the team and helpful to the city. So, in light of the decision that they made this week, I think you could make, at the very least, I think you could make a pretty compelling argument that it seems like there's a likelihood that they didn't trade Pickard for financial reasons. And that's really kind of unfortunate, because, again, I go back to the analogy with the Seahawks and the Mariners. I think that in the end, if you make decisions based on competition, and you make things based on the long-term goals of the franchise, I think you're better off in the long run, as opposed to trying to make putting Band-Aids over things and making short-term decisions that ultimately may come back to haunt you. So who knows? I mean, I know at the time officially Russ Farwell said that they didn't receive an offer that they liked for Calvin Pickard. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's not. I'll have to take him at his word that they didn't get what they felt was necessary. But it certainly seemed like it was not only unfortunate for the team, but a little bit unfortunate for Calvin Pickard too, who spent most of his career playing for teams that were not very good here. And it would have been nice to see him go to a team that would have for sure been in the playoffs and given him a shot to make a long playoff run.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching him, and I still have the memory of I remember the final game. His final regular season game was here in Portland, and they had a chance. I believe if they would have won that game, they would have qualified for the playoffs. And I think it ended up being, I think it was 8-2. Portland won that game, and he was trying so hard to keep his team in that game. And there were a couple of times when a goal had gone by, and he just, it just all like came onto him at once, because he just basically collapsed in a heap.
Yeah.
With his face buried in the ice. And I'm just thinking, like, I felt so bad for the kid because he had given so much of them for so long and got no reward out of it at all.
Yeah, and I felt bad for him as well. And this is and I don't want this to sound like a knock on him, but I think that as I recall, after the trade deadline and after he wasn't traded, I remember that there was a short period of time where he really kind of struggled. And I would have to guess that, you know, not being traded probably had an impact on him. I mean, I know publicly he said all the right things and said, you know, he was fine with not being traded and he loved Seattle and he was proud to be a lifelong career Thunderbird. But, you know, the way he played for a short stretch after the trade deadline kind of suggested otherwise. He just looked distracted. He just didn't look like he was quite as sharp, you know, as he had been most of his career. But there was no doubt that it was a huge disappointment not to make the playoffs this year, probably for not only him personally, but for the fans and for the organization. It was kind of a tough blow.
All right, so this series coming up. Now, I on Twitter tweeted out my own predictions, and I actually picked Seattle in 7 in this series.
I saw that, yeah.
And the reason, and I had told a couple people this, I think Seattle was designed to wear a team down over the course of 7 games, and Everett's a team that's already a little banged up, and you have to think that they have several of their key players. They're playing, but they're probably not playing at 100%, and it just seems like, you look at that series with Kelowna last year, I mean, Kelowna was decimated after going 7 with Seattle. They couldn't even put up a fight against Kamloops after that with as good of a team as they had. And Seattle's a better team now than they were last year. So it seems to me, I just feel like in a 7 games over the course of 10 days or 11 days or whatever it is, to me, favors a team that can wear the other team out. And I think that the Thunderbirds are that kind of team.
Yeah, I could see that happening. I definitely think that that's a legitimate breakdown of the series. And I will also say that while I doubt that Kelowna is sitting around trembling in their skates about the Seattle Thunderbirds, I can bet you that there are at least a few people in that organization that are probably rooting for Everett to win this series because they probably don't want to have another matchup with Seattle in the second round, just simply because I don't think that Kelowna, while they're, you know, an excellent team, I don't think that they're a very good matchup for Seattle because Seattle does tend to push them around a little bit. That's kind of what they did in the playoff series last year, and I think they would probably wind up doing that again this year. But to get back to the what you're saying on the Everett series, I think that could happen. And I talked a little bit about it in the post today, and I talked about it with my co-writer John a little bit as well. I think a really underrated aspect of the series here is whether Seattle can inflict that will on Everett while maintaining their the line of discipline. You know, I think if Seattle's able to forecheck and is able to hit people and cause turnovers, you know, in the attacking zone without getting penalties, without taking penalties, I think that you're absolutely right. I think they could wear them down over the course of a 7-game series. The flip side is true, though. If Seattle somehow, you know, picks up either lazy penalties or undisciplined penalties, as you know from watching some of the Seattle-Portland games, as they are known to do at times, it could be a long series or I guess a short series, because I think that not only does that give Everett, you know, power play chances, which are golden for a team that doesn't score a whole lot of goals, but it also, I think, would dial back their aggressiveness a little bit. I mean, the one thing Seattle probably has to do, and I think the coaching staff knows this and they're probably drilling it into their heads over and over again, and they will continue to do it all series, is that even if they get a few penalties, they can't afford to back down. I mean, they can't afford to just simply you know, chip it past defenders and not punish a defender beyond the goal line and give them a free pass out of the zone. If ever defenders are having an easy time retrieving the puck and making a first pass, you know, it's going to be difficult. But like you said, you know, Seattle is the one thing that Seattle does have and does very well is they've got size. It's always been, for good or for bad, that's been Russ Farwell's calling card, especially for the last 4, 5, 6 years, is we've got a lot of big players. We've got a lot of guys who can hit, a lot of guys who can fight, And while fighting is probably less important in a series like this, in a playoff series, the checking aspect of it is not underrated. And if you can go into the corners and dislodge the puck from defenders, make it difficult for them to break out of the zone and create offensive chances like that, they've got a chance. If they can't, I just don't see Seattle with the raw offensive ability to be able to score on an Everett team if they can't do that. You know, some of the scorers that Seattle has really are kind of scuffling right now. You know, Brendan Truk scuffling a little bit. Robert Slipsberg's struggling a little bit. Alexander Delnov's been parked on the fourth line several times over the last couple weeks of the season. So suddenly if those guys are not going well and you're not getting those turnovers and you're not getting those turnover chances in the attacking zone, you're really kind of relying on guys like Matthew Barzal and Ryan Gropp to generate offense for you, and they can, but that's a lot of pressure to be putting on a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old in their very first playoff series in the WHL.
Back to what you're getting at, discipline seems to be really the such a big thing for them because – yeah, games down here in Portland. I remember a game here not that long ago. I think it was the game here that Portland won 3-0, where the T-Birds were on the penalty kill a lot in that game. And people talked about the disparity. I think power plays were like 8-2 in that game or something like that. And it was one of those games where you can watch a game and you can see, okay, one team is getting the benefit of the doubt tonight, or one team's getting the favorable officiating. But that was one of those games where I thought, you know, there was kind of a line. The officials had established a line, and the T-Birds were simply just crossing that line more often than Portland was. But then you'll also see them up there playing at home, and even against Portland last week when Portland won, the T-Birds are doing a pretty good job of baiting guys like Leipzig and Patan into committing some silly penalties, while also not really committing a lot of silly penalties themselves. So, but it's a matter of, can they actually do that? Can they go to a hostile environment and kind of not lose their cool? Because they tend to come down here and lose their cool when they come to Portland.
Yeah, and I will say I think there are times when they go up to Everett and they lose their cool as well. And I think that's something that, you know, physical, emotional teams absolutely have to be aware of and have to be careful of, because you go on the road like that. And I will say at times I don't, you know, as with every hockey fan, I don't necessarily agree with all the calls. But a team that is that physical is going to be susceptible probably to more penalties than a finesse team. You know, fans can bemoan all day long that Portland may seem to get more calls, so to speak, than Seattle. But the fact of the matter is that Portland's also not putting themselves in a position to get called as much as the Thunderbirds are. I mean, they're just simply not. I mean, they're not throwing as many checks. They're more of a finesse team. They're certainly faster, I think, and so they're not picking up as many what you would call lazy penalties, the trippings, the hookings, things like that. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If they can stay out of trouble, I think they've got a shot. But if they you know, lose their cool up in Everett or even at home and let officiating get to them at times, then, you know, it's going to be trouble, which is ultimately why I'm not sure I'm buying into it. I think Everett is really buying into their systems right now. I think they appear to be very confident in their defensive abilities. They're really confident in their trapping abilities. And Seattle's a type of team that is not well suited to beat that type of a system, because they just simply don't play fast enough to break through that neutral zone trap, if you want to call it that, and get pucks deep in the zone. If they can, like I said, if they can get the puck deep and inflict some punishment on the puck carriers behind the line there, they've definitely got a chance. But I don't know. I haven't seen it enough from them lately. I haven't seen enough commitment to that game plan enough. I think there are too many guys who either think or hope or wish they were skilled players, or think they have more skill than they really do, and are not necessarily sticking to the game plan to execute against a team that hasn't lost in regulation in 13 games, which is a pretty impressive role.
It's funny, I remember in the preseason Everett was scoring a bunch of goals, and we were thinking like, oh, maybe it's a different Kevin Constantine, and it's totally not.
Same old, same old.
But it's working right now because they got healthy finally a little bit. Not real healthy. I mean, Baumel's out, Sandu hasn't played, but I mean, they were really in bad shape. They didn't really have a full team for, gosh, a couple months there from December through, you know, through the end of January when they really, really struggled.
And it's interesting you mentioned that because we haven't even talked about it yet, but the complete wild card of this series is what the status is on Austin Lotz and Kyra as well, because you know, I kind of went, I actually went through and watched the video from Saturday, and I would have to imagine that Lotz is okay, because I didn't really see anything that happened to him that dramatically. Kyra, on the other hand, looked like he took a pretty nasty bump. But the status of those two guys is, I mean, obviously Lotz being the biggest one. If Lotz can't go, especially with Daniel Cotton being sent home early in the season, I mean, that's a huge blow to them. But I expect Lotz to be in there. I really can't see him being out. Although, Constantine, I apparently was pretty coy about it the other day, not leading on to whether they were healthy or not.
Yeah, he was not giving Nick Patterson anything to go on.
I'm
obviously not surprised on that.
No.
Got a couple minutes left here. Getting to play Everett in a playoff series now, what's the rivalry like with the Silver Tips compared to what it's like with Portland? I mean, the Portland one goes back so many more years, but can you compare those two rivalries from a fan perspective? Similar, different? I mean, how?
Well, I think it's difficult to characterize, and I'm sure I'm not going to make any friends saying this either, but from an honest perspective, I think that the difference between the two rivalries is this. With Portland, the rivalry goes back so far, and there are so many of the, what I would say, the hardcore fans that also have friends that are Portland fans. Being a guy that went to college down in Oregon, I have a small handful of them who still live down there who I have to live with all the time, being Winterhawk fans and Oregon Duck fans, and I have to tolerate them constantly.
Yeah.
There's I think a tad bit more mutual respect, whereas I think that the rivalry with Everett is a little bit more it's a little bit more bitter, and I think I say that especially because with Everett having the success that they did initially going to the WHL championship and you know, not missing the playoffs for all these years, and constantly having this mantra that they don't rebuild, they just reload, et cetera, et cetera. And T-Bird fans have always been kind of the, you know, I don't even know if we're still lovable, but we've been sort of the lovable losers for a long time. You know, we only have a couple of banners. We've been to the WHL championship exactly the same number of times that Everett did in their first season. So I think there's a little bit of resentment there and a little bit of, cockiness and arrogance that comes from the Everett fan base that rubs Seattle the wrong way. Now, I will say that there's probably a little bit more bitterness and resentfulness of the Portland Winterhawks in the past several seasons as Portland has gotten good again. I remember saying to a buddy of mine when Portland was really down in the dumps, how I actually felt kind of guilty playing Portland and saying and chanting Portland sucks, because it just wasn't as much fun when they actually did suck. that much. And now, of course, you know, we chuckle about that now, because we're like, oh man, I can't believe I ever felt sorry for these guys. And right. So that sort of, you know, feeling has sort of dissipated a little bit. But that's what I would say is the biggest difference, is Portland has just been it's been a rival for a much longer period of time that I think there's a certain level of mutual respect that I'm not really sure exists between Seattle and Everett. And if you even want to boil it down to the whole, you know, Bill Yule selling the franchise and selling out the Thunderbirds and taking the team up in Everett, that probably is a small part of it as well.
And just briefly, your thoughts on when the Portland sanctions came out, if we're getting the full story. And it was,
no way. And it, no chance.
You don't think there's any chance we're getting the full story?
No chance we're getting the full story. That's my take. And maybe, you know, look, I'll be the first person to admit, maybe I'm just a biased Seattle blogger, and that's probably a fair assessment and a fair critique. But I just don't think, because I guess what I would say is, put it this way, and I think I wrote this at the time. If that's really all that they did, and that's all that happened, the punishment did not fit the crime. And even as a Seattle fan that you know, loved to see the hammer get dropped on Portland to a certain extent, I'd be the first person to admit that the punishment just did not seem to fit the crime based on the way the crime was presented. So that's my theory, is that we probably never will get the entire story, but who knows?
And I suspect, actually, well, I don't know. Portland is still supposedly working with the league on getting some of those draft picks back. And I think what's going to happen here, this is my theory, the WHL is going to adopt some of the changes that the OHL just did to player benefit violation rules.
Yeah.
And some of those things that the Winterhawks were on record for getting in trouble for, I think, are now going to become okay. And I think you might see a couple of those picks come back to Portland when that happens.
That's quite possible. And that would probably be telling, because I think what that would sort of signal is maybe that's all there really was. I mean, maybe that's all it really was. Now, the other thing I've heard, and again, this is just hearsay and rumor, but the other thing that I heard that I did think was quite possible was that that the league suspected that Portland had done a lot more than what they had reported, but they just couldn't find concrete proof of it. And so that in light of not having proof, which of course is completely totalitarian, probably not fair and probably not right, but again, just rumor and hearsay, that they suspected that they had done more. They didn't have proof for it, so they just decided, well, we'll just make the sanctions be harsher than what they appear to maybe be appropriate. So who knows?
Yeah, and it's frustrating down here. I mean, as much as obviously down here the fan base here is going to be apologists, but
sure.
There's frustration here that this has never really been made clear really what happened, and
yeah,
the people who were trying to make some sort of objective judgment about it, it's just there's nothing really to go on to say, okay, if this is really what happened, then you know, but it's there's so many assumptions that it's not the whole story that
and I think that's fair, and I feel bad for you guys until I see your first power play unit roll out all NHL draft picks, and then I just have a hard time feeling bad for you guys. I just don't feel as bad.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit at odds with some people down here who maintain that. I mean, Mike Johnson has done a very good job. I don't think anybody can doubt that. But
absolutely,
there are some who think he's a mad genius who just has this ability to magically find these players, you know, from nowhere. But I will say that the team only won the team would not have won the Western Hockey League championship last year without draft picks that were earned by being a terrible team for a few years.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, and I think the frustrating thing is, and we could, of course, we could probably talk for hours, but the frustrating thing for Seattle fans has always been, you know, look at a team like Portland that saw their fortunes go, you know, not so well and have high draft picks and draft excellently, you know, guys like Derek Pouliot that, you know, have, you know, taken them back to the tops of the league. And then Seattle has guys like, you know, say Jared Hoff, who, you know, not that Jared Hoff is not a really good player or not a really bad player, but he was the fourth overall pick in the Bantam draft, and he is certainly no Derek Pouliot. So,
right.
I agree with you. I mean, absolutely, you can have good coaching, and Johnson's done a fantastic job, but you still have to draft well, and you have to hit on those picks in order to rise back up in the league ranks for sure.
And they're throwing a lot of resources at scouting and drafting and things like that. You know, money isn't really an object so much for
and
for
I think
the ownership
that helps
here.
A lot.
That certainly helps, and you know,
100%.
But anyway, I know you need to get going, so I will let you go. And thank you again very much for doing this. A lot of fun, and
yeah, thank you. Anytime, and I'm happy to do it again. And like I said, I'm sorry I have to go. Probably could have chatted for another hour.
Done this forever, but. But I'll be following your series. Good luck to the Thunderbirds, and you probably hope that my prediction is true and not yours.
I will certainly hope that your prediction is true and not mine. So we'll hope that you are much smarter than I am.
All right. Thanks, Tyler.
All right, thanks, Scott.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye-bye. I want to thank Tyler Hunnix again for joining me tonight. You can read his stuff at letsgobirds.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Tyler Hunnix. That's TYLERHUNNEX. Got more coming up soon here on the podcast. Have a couple more scheduled right now. Don't have them totally 100% confirmed, so stay tuned, and those will be coming out soon. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast here, planning to increase the coverage a little bit as we get into the playoffs. This is really the when things heat up in the WHL, so really hoping that we can provide some kind of fill a little bit of a hole in coverage that sometimes we get down here. So really looking forward to the next couple of months here.